Blog Talk Radio.
This is TS Radio in coordination with Marcel Reed at the Whistleblowers Summit. And I'm Marcia Joyner, host of Betrayed by Hospice. Thank you to our producer, Marty Oakley, for affording us the opportunity to talk about topics that are uncomfortable and many do not want you to know because it might just change your opinion about what you have always believed and you might decide to take a different path and not hospice. I know I will. This show was created to bring awareness to people about the dangers of enrolling their loved ones or themselves into hospice without knowing the facts and not the fiction that many hospice staff tell you. Some people have had positive experiences, but most I've spoken to have not. You need to be aware so you can make educated decisions and recognize red flags. The fact is, that hospice services were meant to be compassionate and helpful in the dying process at the end of someone's life. They were to minimize pain for the actively dying, not to drug a person into unconsciousness until they can't think, talk, eat, drink, or swallow, and ultimately hasten their death with drugs and dehydration. It's a horrible way to have the last chapter of your life executed, and yet, this is what is happening across the country. It was intended for people who had diseases that could no longer be treated with medication. However, hospice has tumbled down a slippery cliff, enrolling people who can be treated with medication and who aren't terminal. And the fact is, nobody can predict when someone will die, and as long as you are being treated successfully with medication, your death should be natural and not hastened. Today, the criteria for enrolling in hospice has been watered down to include people who may have difficulty dressing or eating or who may be incontinent, or if somebody has been to the hospital more than 3 times within 6 months, called a frequent flyer, and I'll talk about that in just a minute, any of these might make you eligible for hospice. As many of you may be aware, a UTI, a urinary tract infection, can cause confusion, lack of appetite, weight loss, fatigue, irritability, decreased mobility, restlessness, hallucinations, and that could cause someone to appear that they have dementia, or they stop eating, or they're falling, or they become incontinent. So my question is, would a UTI mean that you're going to die in 6 months and therefore you need to be in hospice? It can if it's not treated, and yet I hear of patients with UTIs not being treated in hospitals, nursing homes, and hospices. What if the person was young? Would they be treated the same way? Probably not, but when a person is old, they are considered disposable. That's just a fact, not my belief. It is happening all the time, and yet the elderly are not protected, but are actually preyed upon and called for extinction. So when I was talking about a frequent flyer, that's someone who goes to the hospital 3 times in 6 months for if they have a broken bone, having a hard time breathing, for any reason that you go in, it triggers a call to a nearby hospice, and someone shows up to discuss how they can help you from going to the hospital or having to visit your doctor's office. They can come to your home, provide meals, sitter services, and it won't cost you anything because Medicare or Medicaid will pay for it. Well, here's the catch. Once you enroll, you will be doomed because it has been determined you cost too much money and it's cheaper to drug you into a coma and hasten your death than to medically treat you. They will conveniently stop giving you your medications, although they will tell you, no, we don't do that. We'll continue with your medications. That's a lie. In many cases, as you will hear, they stop giving them regular medications. They say, we'll bring a comfort kit to your home just in case you need it. They're great manipulators. They're trained how to deceive. It saves the government money. It pads the pockets of those who own these facilities and who work there. And the hospice worker gets to add it to his or her quota. The hospital saves because you won't be back to their facility for help, and they won't have anybody breathing down their neck saying, why did this person come back? Obviously, you didn't take care of it the first time. So it's a win-win situation for everyone except the patient and their family. The patient will pay the ultimate fee of their life. Michelle Young Duers provides details of this in her book, Killing for Profit: The Dark Side of Hospice. She was a hospice respiratory therapist and saw the quotas and the treatment of hospital and hospice patients firsthand. I encourage you to check out this book. It is very informative. And I'm not advocating that if somebody is suffering from cancer or an incurable disease that can't be treated and they're in pain, they should be given a small amount of morphine. That's not what I'm saying. They should be given something, and it should be increased only as needed and only when they are aware of what the drug will do. They shouldn't be given large amounts and frequent and along with antipsychotic drugs that render them unconscious and take away the last days or hours with their family. They should know all the facts, and the family needs to know what's going on. They need to be able to make choices and not be tricked. That's my issue about comfort care. Families are not told the truth, nor are the patients. Someone, a nurse or a doctor, decides it's time for them to die for whatever reason, because they're in pain or because they're sick or because they're old. Doesn't make any difference. You don't have the right to decide when it's someone's time to die. This week in a Facebook group, there was a post talking about how wonderful hospice was, and it was encouraging people to consider it as an option for those who have been caught in nursing homes during COVID. Of course, being the outspoken elder advocate that I am and that I'm passionate on this subject, I certainly disagreed to that post. My intent is not to argue with someone who believes hospice is wonderful or to discount their positive experience with hospice. I think that's great for them. But to tout to others that hospice is wonderful and to accept them at their word is a fate I would wish on no one. And I cannot, in good conscience, let their word stand. So I warn people of the dangers, and then I let it go unless someone wants more information. As my mama always said, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink. I would never try to make someone feel guilty about their choice to enroll in hospice. And while I believe that many patients were euthanized, like my mom and thousands of others, I have no intention of telling someone who just lost a loved one with hospice involved that I believe they were euthanized. That's not my place, and it's after the fact, it's too late. And why add to someone else's grief? I just don't believe in doing that. But I do believe in warning people beforehand and letting them know their choices. They don't have to go with hospice. There are other avenues, and to see the red flags, because I don't want anybody to experience what I did with my mom. And so with that, I say all hospices are not bad. All the ones I'm aware of are. But there are some pro-life. You just have to look and find them. There are some that treat the patient with dignity and don't hasten their death. Should you be enticed into a facility that says we care and will do no harm, and then knowingly they start the path to euthanasia? I don't think so, but you need to do your homework. At hospicepatients.org, Ron Panzer, also a previous hospice nurse, shares countless stories about what hospice is now. He has a book titled Stealth Euthanasia, Healthcare Tyranny that you can download. Very informative site. and I encourage the listeners to check it out. That's hospicepatients.org. Another good site is halovoice.org, and they have a 24/7 helpline. This is new. If you have any questions while your loved one is in the facility or if you are thinking about putting them in hospice, you can call them and talk to them and ask questions. Get information before you make that decision. That number is 888-221-HALO, H-A-L-O. The fact is stealth euthanasia, because it is happening in front of us but under the radar, and people are totally unaware until it's too late, and then you're racked with grief and guilt of not saving your loved one. Hospice says the person is dying, and they are at that point, but they're dying from the drugs and the dehydration. If you gave a strong, healthy, young person the same drugs that our loved ones are given, the duration and the combination, they would die not from any disease because they're healthy, right? They'll die from the drugs and the dehydration. So how is this not murder? It is murder. That's just a fact. I personally do these shows because my mother was euthanized in Georgia in the summer of 2017, and I could not live with myself if I did not warn other people. I am not alone. This is happening across the globe. And now with COVID, the governors sent COVID-positive patients to the nursing homes knowing what it would do, knowing those were the most vulnerable people. And yet they talked about, we have to take the prisoners out. They're in confined spaces. We don't want to leave them there. So prisoners are treated better than our elderly in the nursing homes. Why are people not totally outraged by that and by what hospice is doing? Our loved ones are guilty of no crime except getting old, and thus they are considered expendable. People talk to me, they say they use the same drugs on them that were used on my mom, the same words they say. It's horrible. Tonight, our guest is Jenny Tombelson Reed. On August the 14th of this year, 2020, Jenny's parents would have celebrated their 71st anniversary, but sadly, they were not able to. Tragically, Jenny lost both of her parents this year within a four-month time frame. We've talked often about toxic drugs that hospice gives our loved ones, which render them unable to think, speak, eat, or drink. Drugs that put them into a coma and they die from starvation and dehydration, which is a horrible and painful way to spend your last few days, and it's devastating for the family to watch this murder in slow motion, powerless to save them. But tonight, we're going to go in depth about other ways that hospice betrays patients and their families, with promises made but not kept. It brings to light more of the stories that are told in the book, Killing for Profit. The part of hospice behind the scenes where there really is no compassion for our loved one and there is no intention of following through on what they say to entice people to enroll. Once in, everything changes, and what you were told is hearsay. So with that, I'd like to welcome Jenny to our show and to give her the floor. Jenny, I know it's been recent for you with losing both parents, and this is hard. I appreciate you coming and talking to our listeners and letting them know the story about your precious parents. So I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Marcia. I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share our heartbreaking story and journey that we've experienced over the last 6 months. Well, first of all, I'd like to start out saying that over the last 7 years, I was honored to be able to care for both of my mom and dad. My dad had been diagnosed with Alzheimer's, and over the last few years, he had gotten to a level of care that we could no longer provide for him and had to place him in a memory care. And that was about 18 months ago. And my mom had all of her faculties to her. She was an avid reader. She loved walking. She could get out and do what she wanted to do. We could go shopping and just enjoyed life. We traveled as a family, even my dad. And we've had some fun trips. But over the last 18 months, it's been difficult for my mom to have to see my dad be placed. So getting to the current story, I'll start with the day after Christmas, which is my daughter's birthday. We had gone out that day, my mom and my daughter Callie and I, as we always do every year, to go celebrate her day, her birthday, with shopping and nails, dinner. My mom had exhibited no issues, no problems, nothing. When we would go on these power days of outings, we would put her in a transport wheelchair because that's a lot for a 91-year-old lady to cover. And we had a lot of ground to cover. So on that day, we were good. So on the 28th, a couple days later, my mom stated that she just didn't feel like herself and wanted to see her doctor. Well, we tried to get in, but we couldn't, as a lot of the staff were out on vacation and holiday during that week, and they had actually advised us to go to an acute care clinic. Well, my mom was an old RN of 50 years, and she didn't want to do that. She didn't feel that bad, and she was stubborn and set in her ways, and I've learned just to go along with it. It's not worth fighting. But on the evening of the 30th, that night, about 3 a.m., my dog woke me up, and I thought she needed to go out potty, and she led me downstairs into my mom's room. My mom's light was on, which was not unusual, as she, like I said, is an avid reader and would stay up late reading, and she was sitting on the side of her bed and having a hard time breathing and with shortness of breath. Well, I asked her if she wanted to go to the ER, and she said no. She just wanted me to sit there by her and pray over her and with her. So I did. And then I suggested that maybe she put on her CPAP mask, which actually had a direct line of oxygen from her oxygen generation machine. And so she did that. She was able to relax. Her breathing came back into normal, and she actually drifted off to sleep. I stayed with her until through that night and into the morning, and she didn't have any further issues. So the next day, the 31st, New Year's Eve, that morning, I had asked her how she was doing, and she said just not herself. And I told her that after my dad's doctor's appointment that we and lunch, we would need to go to the ER and get checked out. I said this just wasn't normal for her, and she agreed. During lunch, I noticed that she didn't eat anything, which was very, very unusual for her. And that was a huge red flag to me. After dropping Dad off at his place and getting him settled, we proceeded to the ER. And at that time, we discovered that she had a fever, shortness of breath, and the x-ray showed that something, the doctors were calling pneumonia, but we're not sure. So they admitted her, and they treated her as such. Over the next 4 to 5 days, Mom continued to get worse, and the doctor said that they were giving her the highest level of antibiotics, right under the superbug antibiotics, and also very large levels of prednisone. They stated that she had some type of pneumonia and that she also was in an end stage of interstitial lung disease. We had no clue she had this disease. She had not exhibited any signs of having such disease, and we all were just very perplexed by that. She was also on a high-flow oxygen and at very high level to keep her O2 stats up above 90. They also started respiratory therapy, but she failed the PT eval as her O2 stats would drop dangerously. They stated that they just couldn't do any more for her at that time. And she continued with the RT prednisone, but she was suffering with her breathing, and she was having panic attacks and continued to decline. So at that time, it was a good week into this, the doctors started talking about going under hospice, but they just couldn't do any more for her, and the decline was there, and we were just shocked by this. Then in this hospital, there was a hospice company associated with them and actually had an office within the facility, the hospital facility. So the hospice girl came by, and she met up with us just to talk about some of their services. Well, she, you know, explained to us what they could help, which was keep mom on her O2, and they would try to help her wean off, and they would keep her as long as she needed, as long as she had. We weren't given a deadline or anything, and that we would never see a bill. And so I'm like, okay. So we met, we made a formal meeting and went over that, the same promises and more on that, and signed the contract and engaged with them. That was on the 10th, January the 10th, which is a Friday. On the 11th, the next day, Saturday, hospice moved her to their in-house facility, that was an off-site facility there, by ambulance. Upon arriving, we were pulled immediately, we being my daughter and I and my brother, who had come in town, were pulled into a meeting to meet with the hospice administrator, where they told us that she could only be there for 3 to 5 days, and that they would only, and then at that point, we would be charged $350 a day. Well, I was just shocked because that's not what I was told, and I was just confused by that, and it was just immediately, I mean, they were rolling my mom in her room, and they were pulling us over here. So anyway, we had not initially were told any of this, so it was really confusing. While in the meeting, while we were in the meeting, the nursing staff was taking care of mom. They were actually bathing her, and they were placing a catheter at that time and just getting her positioned in her room. And it was a private room, and that was nice to have that privacy. We came in after we finished that that meeting, and the RN nurse came in and was giving her an injection. And I asked, well, what are you giving her? You know, I'm like, talk to me. And she said, oh, I'm giving her Ativan and Dilaudin, which I'm not sure if I'm saying that right, but I think it's a pain medicine. And we had not discussed at all any type of care plan. There was no discussion as to what they were going to do for her medically as a medicine, or continue her meds. She's a diabetic. And so I was really surprised that all of a sudden they're just doing what they want to do. Well, I was, she said that it would help her pain and anxiety. Well, I didn't know what it was until later. And so I was okay with it because I thought that it might help her. And she was in discomfort, and she was having anxiety from the breathing. Like, she was very stressful for her and having panic attacks. So I thought, well, that probably wouldn't hurt. So I informed the staff, though, not to give her anything. She hated taking heavy narcotic drugs. This may just be from her nursing career. She's had a long, beautiful nursing career of all different types of areas of care. So she was very careful about her medications and not getting on any narcotics, and she wasn't. So I made that clear. My daughter, Callie, stayed with her in her room overnight, and so we were with her 24/7. So on the next day, when I arrived that first thing in the morning, I saw my mom sitting up in bed with her reading glasses on, reading her Bible. And I said, well, good morning. Where have you been? And she said she was much better and that she wanted to know what was going on and what had happened and where is she. So I explained everything to her. See, my mom didn't have dementia, so it wasn't like, you know, she wasn't aware. She was very aware of things. So I explained everything to her and that she was dealing with an end-stage type of lung disease and that she was in hospice. Well, she wasn't happy about that at all and wanted to get out. She wanted to get PT. She says, I'm so weak. And she didn't want to stay there. And she wanted me to get her moved out. And I said, I would. So, you know, being that she was a sound mind, you know, we were having a conversation. And I'm like, okay, well, let me get on that. We will get this taken care of. So the next day, Monday, you know, I actually met with that hospice administrator, social worker there, and informed her. This is the same one that gave us this meeting the moment we walked in. And I informed her that my mom's wishes were to be moved to a rehabilitation center. And she said that she would help. She would give out referrals. So during that stay, we also asked for respiratory therapy for her. And they finally did. And it took several days for that. Now, get in mind, this is Monday, so people coming into work. They don't work on the weekend, the main administration staff. They only work during the week. So things are not happening over the weekend. It's pretty calm there. So I informed them, you know, no drugs. We want to get out of here. We want to get moved. She wants RT. She needs respiratory therapy. And finally, I think it was Tuesday afternoon, respiratory finally came down the evaluator, and then they started her on that respiratory therapy a little bit. The nurse and the CNAs, they would do things to her. My mom, I witnessed them not taking the best care, not all of them, but a lot of them there, that when they would need to move my mom in her bed, that they would have to invert the bed so they could slide her to the top of the bed and then bring it back up. Well, that would always put her in a panic because of all the fluid in her lungs, and she would feel like she's drowning, which I'm sure that's probably what was happening. And I would explain to them before they start the process to please, please do it very quickly. I don't want to panic her. And please, just do it as fast as you can. When they start the process, they get to the point where they have her inverted. And then they just start taking their time. They would talk about the day, what they're doing over the weekend. I'm sitting there going, and I'd start having a fit. My mom was having a panic attack, begging for help. And I couldn't stand it, so I grabbed the bed controls and I started moving her. Well, I'm sure that they didn't appreciate that or my demand as to not giving her meds or anything. Finally, that would calm her down, of course, and she would come back, but it would take her a long time, and we would breathe through it. We would talk, we would hold her hand, whatever she needed, you know, to calm her down. It was an awful thing for somebody to be tortured that way. On Thursday, I had not heard a thing from that social worker about the status of those referrals to the PT, to the physical therapy facilities, rehab. And I met with her. I found her, tracked her down, and asked her what was going on. And she stated that she had not heard anything. And I said, well, I need to start calling these places. We need to start getting a little more progressive. So she told me who she sent the referrals to. she said she'd called with no messages back, nobody calling her back. And I just started calling. I just started calling facilities. We have one really large rehabilitation center here, and then there's lots of small ones. So I started calling and leaving messages, and not one person, I never spoke to a person, and nobody never called me back. I was really just feeling upset and distraught, and I felt like nobody cared about my mom. I really did. And here hospice is supposed to be, you know, the care facility.
On the Friday, compassion.
I'm a social worker. Yeah, there wasn't any for my mom.
Right. And your mom wants to get out at this point, is probably asking you, Jenny, you know, get me out of here.
Yes. She doesn't understand. She knows me. I mean, like, she knows I'm going to do what I say I'm going to do. So, and I'm letting her know along the way, too, what's going on. So, anyway, I talked to the social worker, and she said that none of the rehabilitation centers would take her due to the high level of oxygen she was on. She was at 8 liters of oxygen. It was a lot less than what she was in the hospital. So she did graduate greatly from the high flow oxygen, because they couldn't transport her in an ambulance without being at a certain level of oxygen. So I started calling again, and then I decided to call some home health care facility companies to try to find help. And we were on hold with everybody. It was like not one person could help me. They tried. I mean, several of these home health companies actually were calling all kinds of different facilities for us. On the 20th, which is Monday, met with us, discussed her placement options. Because, you know, she's past the 3 to 5 days and way past it, because now we've been there I don't know how many days, but enough for them to talk to us about moving her. So they said they were still trying to find a rehabilitation facility. I really don't think there was much effort put into that, to tell you the truth, just from the attitude. And they started talking about nursing home placement. Financially, we could not afford a nursing home because we were paying for my dad's memory care as it was a private facility, and it was out of pocket, not Medicaid. So I know financially this was not something we could afford at all, and because nursing homes are a lot more money financially, you know, monthly. So hospice was going to assist in helping us get her filing for Medicaid, and that we would start the application process. Well, that was a process in itself, but they were causing, I don't know, they were just causing me a lot of grief and questions, and I decided to, I reached out to an elder law attorney to help me get some questions, because I was at a point where I needed some legal advice because I didn't know what to do. So I did. I was actually blessed to be able to get in quickly with a really good elder law attorney here, and she gave me some wonderful advice. She actually said that she could file the Medicaid for us if we wanted to, but she actually worked hand-in-hand with hospice to help them get through it, and she did not charge us for that, but she did, you know, other charges. But I thought that was wonderful for her to help us that way. So that was on the 20th when all that, like the Monday. So now I'm going to the 29th, Wednesday the 29th. 9 days later, the hospice facility. Now my mom's still declining because now she's weak. She's not able to now get out of bed to go, you know, to get up, and she can't even get herself sitting up in bed anymore. she's so weak because she's losing her muscle strength. So
can I back you up a second?
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. So when you said when the first day that they put her in there, they put a catheter on her. Was she not able to get? Yeah. Was she not able to get out of bed?
She could, because she didn't have one in the hospital, actually.
Right.
They just automatic. I mean, it was like, bam, here you go. You know, she was actually able to get out of bed. She could actually walk to the bathroom. On day one. This is why I'm
See, and that's my point. That's my point. And when you were saying that her muscles, she was losing her ability, her muscles, because they put a catheter in her. It sounds to me it was not necessary, but it makes it easier on the staff because they don't have to get up and come in there and help her. And it also puts her in a position where she loses muscles, and she becomes very dependent on them. And this is all part of their trickery. I'm telling you, it's it is all planned.
Exactly. They have a structure. They had a structure to their. I mean, it was they were on it. You know, they were following their protocols. Bam, bam, bam.
Exactly.
And I was like, what? Mm-hmm. What are you doing? Talk to me. Well, you know, they were just like ignoring me. So I was not pleased with any of that. So mom, you know, again, nothing's happening with her physically. Like, she was declining, but not rapidly. And she was declining with her muscle strength. And so anyway, the hospice facility, the hospice officials, meaning the director of nursing, the financial person, and the social worker, they all come in their suits and pads, and so they met with us right there in her room and told us that they were going to move her to one of their other facilities that handles, this is what they told us, that handles respiratory issues and that we could stay there till the end because obviously mom wasn't was not in the active dying stage, but she was declining. So we didn't even have a choice in this. You see, I was handcuffed pretty much to that point because there's not one place willing to take her. There was not, they were calling the shot. And I couldn't bring her home because I didn't have the abilities to do that. We had suffered some issues from taking care of my father to where I know we would not be able to care of my mom at this level. It was a whole different level of care. And so we were pretty much stuck. And I was just pretty much at their, you know, call. Whatever they said, we didn't have a choice. And that really, that really, really upset me. So also, you know, and I'm going to stop here. I didn't know that I could call on other hospice companies too. I didn't know I had options either. Nobody.
Because
you know,
they
I didn't
don't
have
tell you that.
No, they don't. And so I didn't know that. And so I would have, oh my goodness, I would have ran from this company if I had known, but I didn't. So with that, after that conversation on the 29th, they actually moved her to this facility. So that was kind of late in the afternoon, and it was real quiet, and that was okay. But so we got there and settled in, and the nursing staff actually was a little more compassionate and caring than that other one that was at the main facility. So that was a nice change. But on the next day, the 30th, we met with the social worker there at the new facility, and that she informed me that she was going to continue the search for a nursing home to place her. And I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. We were told that my mom, that you guys treat respiratory patients who are declining, they're going to die, but not rapidly, that she could stay here under your care. And she's like, oh, no, no, she can't stay here. We've got to move her out. And I'm like, I don't understand. I'm confused with that. So again, another lie. They just wanted to move her out. They needed her bed. You know, I guess. I don't know. So,
well, I was just going to interject here. One of the things that my sister was told about my mom is when you move a patient, they are very fragile. And when the elderly are moved from one place to another place, it is very difficult on them. So here they've moved your mother from your home. You moved her to the hospital.
Yeah.
She moved from the hospital to the first hospice facility where they lied to you and immediately put a catheter on her, started giving her antipsychotic drugs or anti-anxiety drugs and pain medicine, even though she may or may not have needed it. They never discussed it with you. Then they move her to a second hospice facility, and immediately they're talking about moving her into a nursing home. Each one of those moves is going to be difficult on your mother. Right.
Right.
I just want to point that out to our listeners that this is what they're doing.
Yes. Yeah. It is. It's a strategy. And
it is.
So
it's making your mom
worse. It was very
worse.
Difficult. Yeah, it is. It did. It did. So, of course, the next day, the 31st, the social worker informed us that she had found a nursing home that would be willing to take her at the high oxygen level requirements that she had. Later that afternoon, they transported her again to the nursing home. Fortunately, the nursing home was located in the county we live in, which is the adjacent county from these two facilities. And it's actually just about a mile and a half from my house. So that was a blessing at the end of the day that we were close and we could go home when we needed to and come back quickly. The county, that county's hospice group took over my mom's care at that time because it changed counties. Still the same hospice company, just a different team in a different county. And they would care for her until she passed. So at that up until that point, she wasn't receiving any kind of drugs outside of her normal meds. Because I had stopped all of that back day one or maybe day two because she didn't want it. She's very, I mean, my mom was very clear about these things. She would let me know when she needed something. So mom, though, when we got there, it was a very traumatic experience for her going into a nursing home. Going into a home that was at this kind of level, kind of a lower end nursing home. We didn't have a choice. It was just the only one. And she was very, very, very upset about the whole situation. And we all just, that day, you know, after they got her settled in her room and she was a shared room, we all just cried together. We all just bawled our eyeballs out because we just felt so defeated. You know, like there's just nothing more we can do. And it was just an awful thing to go through. And to see your mom, you know, you care for them for all these years, you know, and you love your mom and dad so much. And they've given their whole life for you, you know, their children and their grandchildren and great-grands. And to get to this point, and both of my mom and dad were servants. My mom was a nurse. So she had a service job, and she loved it. And my dad was a teacher, a coach, a teacher, and a principal. And he loved that job. He loved it. So, you know, for them, I felt like to be treated like this, for her to be treated this way, it was really heartbreaking. And I felt really defeated that I let her down. But my mom then... at that kind of at that point of that move and into the nursing home, she started exhibiting more and more pain and discomfort. And it was just her decline because, you know, nothing had really been done for her physically. And, but the visiting hospice nurse would be providing some comfort aid. I started asking her, my mom has asked about receiving something a little more than the Tylenol because that's all she was taking. And the nurse got the meds approved as PRN, and the nursing home handled all of that accordingly. But my mom declined to a point because she got moved on the 31st. So my mom, like I said, continued to decline, and she was it was a kind of a rapid decline to me, and in and out, and really like expressing pain. And she would tell me, I need something more. So I did work with the hospice nurse. At least they were not pushing it. That was what I was kind of thankful about, where the other place was. And so I was able to help my mom get a little bit. She just needed a little edge, you know?
Right.
But
right.
On February the 11th, my mom was declining more and more and was suffering with her breathing and the pain. I'm thinking probably she's starting to shut down at this point. Like, you know, things are shutting down. And since she's not on any type of monitors, or even though the nurse would come in and check her vitals and such, it was obvious that things were changing in the wrong direction for her. Then I met with the nurse again and asked if they could provide her maybe some low-level comfort meds scheduled for her just so she can have some constant relief. And they worked with that. They did. And it was a low level, but they did give her Ativan as well. So on February the 12th, I got a call. The nursing home did not allow us to stay. Let me back up. The nursing home would not allow us to stay 24/7. They had visiting hours. So we had to leave at 9 o'clock every night. So we were forced to go home. So on the 12th, I got a call at midnight from the hospice nurse stating that she was declining and her blood pressure was dropping, and that we should come be with her, and that she was not responding to them at all. And so that was at midnight. Of course, like I said, I lived right around the corner. So by 12:30, I was by her side. And the minute I walked in, I said, "Mom, I'm here." And she woke right up. And she looked at me, and she gave me her look, and I just loved on her. And I continued to stay by her through the next 36 hours until she passed at 3:15 a.m. the next morning. So the nurse, when I got the call from the original nurse the night before when she was declining, they then put a nurse by her side until she passed, a hospice nurse. And that one was, she was kind, and she did give, she, you know, was letting us know how things were going, you know, like where we were in the process. I had never experienced this. So it was kind of nice to be able to have somebody giving me some insight what to expect, or, oh, this is normal, you know, type stuff. But I'll tell you, with my mom's passing, and I'm just going to say this, is that I was with her, and my brother was with her, and it was the most amazing experience for me, because I actually got to see my mom transition into the kingdom of heaven, because I saw her look of expression of this beautiful radiance over her. And I knew that she was in the presence of our Lord. And that gave me relief that she was okay. And the nurse too, she said it. She goes, "She's meeting Jesus face to face right now." And I'm like, "Yeah, she surely is." And I said, "Mom, keep going." I'm like, don't come back. You've got this." So I was thankful that her suffering was over, but on the other hand, I felt like, you know, when we, now looking back 6 months or now what, eight, I guess 6 months, she probably had COVID. She had every symptom of it, but this was way before any testing or anything. But, you know, she fought a good fight, I'll tell you. And she was ready to go home. You know, she was ready to go home. She was okay with that. Being 91, she lived a wonderful, blessed life. And she was actually planning to live to 100. She'd always told me, I'm living to 100. And I'm like, okay, well, that's fine with me.
Right. Stay on. The decline, now the lung disease that she had, that they
mm-hmm.
said she had, and I don't know if she
right.
really did or if it
I
was
know.
COVID or, you know, I don't know enough about the drug to know,
mm-hmm.
but the decline, I just believe with them moving her around as much as they did and, you know, causing all that, that she they made it worse. And I think you had told me
three moves.
When she was at the nursing home, that she looked up at you, and you know, because she was in a room that she shared with someone else that was noisy. You actually got the room moved, but she said to you, "Why am I here?
Why? And
why did you bring me here?"
Right when they had gotten her settled, and we all had our big crying fest there. That was then. That was that time. She's like, why did you bring me here? Why am I here? And that was just the most saddest point in my life.
Right.
I felt like I had
because you
her.
Can't.
I had
you did
her.
Everything, but you didn't. You did everything you could, and you weren't given a whole lot of options.
No.
So you fought
the
good
part.
Fight. Right. You fought the fight. You did everything you could. And you and your daughter and brother need to understand y'all did everything you could.
Yeah. I know now I did. It was just, it was a hard journey. That was a hard journey. So, you know, with that, we have my dad. And with my dad, he had Alzheimer's, and he was a sweet, gentle soul Alzheimer's. He was not the aggressive. He was super sweet. And so in mid-December, Dad's family physician, they had a group here where we live that has a geriatric elderly group that does house calls, which was such a blessing. And so you don't have to take them out to the doctor or they get sick. You don't have hospice. It's the doctor's office. And the PAs come to them to give them, you know, if they need antibiotics or whatever it is they need. So in mid-December, Dad's doctor had come in to do a complete physical. They do it every 6 months and had determined that he actually needed to have additional baths and had suggested to utilize hospice palliative care side for these items. And I'm like, well, I don't know anything about this. You know, like, okay, this is in mid-December before Mom's sick, right?
Right.
I'm like, okay, well, I guess let's, you know, talk about it. So I met with, the timing is horrible here. So Mom's sick on December 31st. She's in the hospital. On January the 3rd, I'm meeting with hospice, that the same hospice company that Mom was under eventually, and I interviewed this company, and they said that they could provide all these additional services plus a lot more. You know, there's a lot they can offer, and that's how I think they draw you in. And though, you know, maybe that is a good thing for some people financially,
exactly.
because it is paid for by insurance, but for us, we didn't need any of that. My dad was a veteran. He served in the Korean War, and so he had VA benefits that covered pretty much everything that the hospice covers for extra stuff that they give you. So that's another thing for your listeners to understand. If their parents or any of their family members are in veterans or military in any kind, they have these services, and it's free. It doesn't cost anything. So at that time, my mom, on the third, my mom was now in the same hospital that I was meeting this woman for my dad, and we were learning of her health issues. So I'm now dealing with my mom really saying my dad needs help, and I'm thinking, okay. So the hospice told me that they could handle all of his medicines and doctor's visits and all of these things and take it off me so I wouldn't be so stressed during this time with my mom and her care. And I'm thinking, okay, I'm overwhelmed at this point regardless. I mean, like, just dealing with my mom, declining, you know, sick like she was. And now my dad, I'm thinking, okay, you know what? This doesn't sound like a bad thing. Let me go ahead and agree to this because I needed that support, thinking, mm-hmm. you know, because if my mom wasn't doing so well, and I'm thinking, okay, because if she, I don't know how long she's got or any, you know, I don't know what we're dealing with here. So I made sure that I made clear that they didn't do anything without my approval first. I'm a very much big advocate for my mom and dad. I am their team leader, right? And so I was like a mama bear because at this point they're my children. And so that's the role that role happens eventually when you care for your mom and dad when they get up in age, because then they look to you for care and protection. And so I was in that position. And so I thought this was a good thing for me and him and my mom. So I agreed, I signed up, and I made it very, very clear. I make the calls. You don't do anything without me saying A-OK. Well, I engaged with them on the 6th, January the 6th. January 15th, so I'm good. You know, dad's in his place. They're doing their thing. I'm thinking, great, he's being taken care of. Wonderful. Mom is getting ill, not doing well. She's declining. Okay. So I'm getting I'm feeling stability in my life. And then I get a call from dad's facility that he was having a seizure. This was on January 15th. This was 9 days after engaging hospice for him. I'm still not even engaged with hospice for my mom yet. So I'm like, a seizure? And they're like, what do you want us to do? And I'm like, call 911 and get him to the hospital. He's never had a seizure before in his life. I had no idea what the heck was going on with him. And I'm thinking, oh, Lord, my mom is declining, and now my dad's having seizures. I'm not even understanding this. So I'm back, you know. And so they determined that it was actually from dehydration and a UTI. And I'm like, what? So I took him back to his facility after they cleared him and gave him antibiotics and told me, you know, push fluids. And so I picked him up some boost drinks and juices, and he hates water. So I got him whatever, all the things he likes to drink, except sodas. They didn't want him to drink sodas. And so I got him back to his facility, and when I returned, that was later that night, I learned from his home, his facility, that hospice had actually taken him off all of his medicines except the blood thinner that he was on for a blood clotting factor issue, that he should be on a special blood thinner. They took that off of him, and they put him on an aspirin, which does not treat that type of issue.
Mm-mm.
I was so mad. I was livid to learn that. Oh my God. I was just like, mm-mm. He, with this blood clotting issue, he had had a clot that was a life issue. He had a clot, a pulmonary clot, and that's how he learned of his problem. So by them doing that, it wasn't helping him. And I was just like, oh, my gosh. So it was late. It was very late. It was like, you know, 10, 11 o'clock at night. And I had to wait until the morning to deal with it. So first thing on the 16th, the next morning, I called hospice and I let them have it. Oh, I ripped them up down one side and down the other, let me tell you. And I told them that I did not sign them up to kill my dad. I said he just needed to have extra baths. That was all he needed. And here they did this, not telling me anything, and doing all this and hurting him that way. And, of course, I fired them. I was so mad. I wasn't going to deal with that anymore because my mom, I wasn't dealing with hospice for him at that time because my mom was declining, you know, through this time. And actually,
right,
the 16th was when we were being, when was it? I think we were being moved to the hospice facility, I think. Or the nurse, the other facility, somewhere we were getting transferred. But you just see, there's a lot going on with my mom, and I'm like, okay, I'm not dealing with anymore with my dad on hospice. So he got back to status quo because we reinstated everything. He got right back on his meds. Thankfully, I had not disengaged his family physician, which you don't have to with hospice. You can have them as a partner. So I was, he went back to status quo and everything was fine. And then in March 5th.
Well, hold up. I want you to tell our listeners, when you talked to the supervisor and told her what was going on, when you fired them and got another hospice, what did she say to you?
Oh, that's the other one. We haven't gotten there yet. We're not there yet.
Oh, I thought that was when you fired them after your dad, after the medication.
Oh, no, I fired two. So this was the first one I fired, and then I just took a leave from hospice for dad till I got through my mom's period of time because I had to deal with that. And she actually died a month later after I fired this hospice for my dad. So she died a month later. So I was dealing with her, all her, what I told you. So this was mid-February, and then her funeral, and then March 5th, my dad's family physician came and did a wellness check on him, and they told me that he actually needed more and more care, that he was declining. And I noticed that he was declining, but he had just lost his wife of 70 years a few weeks ago. And that I agreed that he needed more care because these facilities, because it wasn't a nursing home, they don't do, there's different levels of care that they provide. So that's where hospice tends to come in and fill in the gaps on this palliative care side of it. And so, but that's not what happened with me when that happened, you know, when I engaged them for that. So on the 8th of March, I met with another hospice and engaged them for his care. And I told them what awful experience that I had had with the other one and what my expectations were with the communication was key. Communication was key. And so I continued to managed and ordered all his medicine. I never relinquished that to them, and you don't have to. And don't let them tell you you have to. And also, I made sure that his family physician was a partnership with them as well. You don't have to disengage your doctor. They can be in the background and being there and consult each other. So this was on the 8th of March. March 12th, the facility had a lockdown because of COVID and our state governor issuing the emergency order to lock all facilities. And I was thankful, actually, at that point, thinking it was a good thing I just got them set back up and that, you know, okay, good, they're still going to be able to come in and care for him. But apparently that's not what happened, because over the next few weeks, dad would have had falls and that they would have to go to the ER and get checked. And I actually met him at the ER because I was his medical power. I was his power attorney and his healthcare surrogate. And so they had allowed me to go into the ER after being checked at the front door for health, you know, COVID. And he was being admitted because his blood pressure was dropping and he was dehydrated. He continued to be dehydrated. And I'm thinking, what the heck? So I had called the memory care facility and asked them if they had noticed, you know, had notified hospice to come and check on him. And when he wasn't acting himself, they had noticed, you know, he wasn't himself. But again, he could have been depressed because he just lost his life, you know. I mean, we've got that factor in there for him. But the nurse said that they called and the nurse never came. And she always had excuses not to come. And then I called the nurse, the hospice nurse, and she gave me all kinds of excuses from too many fires to deal with the facility not letting her come in because of the lockdown. Well, I called the facility manager and go, what is this all about? And they said they have never, ever kept any hospice out that was had patients under their care and that they had called her and she never would come out. And Dad was back in his place after he was in the hospital for a few days and they got his blood pressure steady and got him on some blood pressure meds. He wasn't on blood pressure meds before. And they put him on some blood pressure medicine and got him all hydrated, and he was good to go again. And so they had to transport him by ambulance back because of COVID. Because if I had brought him, he would have had to been in quarantine, of course, because, you know. And so, so that was April. So the month of April, all this happened with him. But on 5/21, May 21st, his family physician, PA, visited him for a wellness check. And she always calls me afterwards and told me that, always, she was very, very, very good about communication and letting me know everything about him, which was nice. And she told me that he was declining and that he had lost 20 pounds since her last visit. And that really just shocked me. And that she said that she didn't think that hospice had been there to care for him. And that they had, I actually had reached out to hospice and found out that they had not. And the nurse and his home stated, confirmed that they had not been out. So they just neglected to take care of him when they were engaged to do so. There was always excuses for him, for them not coming. So that was 5/21. So on 5/25, May 25th, I interviewed the hospice company that was prevalent in that facility, and me and them were not a match. We didn't work, so I didn't engage with them. So on the 28th, I called the dad's physician's office again and discussed my concerns with his care and talked to them about other options. Because lockdown, I'm getting really concerned. He's not getting the care. I could see it through my little window visit. I can tell he's declining. It's just not right. Things are not right. And you feel helpless. The COVID lockdown, you're helpless. And you don't know what to do. So the doctor, I actually was on the phone with the physician. She suggested that the last hospice company that I had not used, number four,
yeah.
I know, right, that she had really good experiences with them. And I said, okay, we'll set up the referral and I'll interview them. So she did. I ended on 6/1, which is June 1st. I interviewed them and explained all of my problems and they were fine with all my expectations and requests. She started on June 1st, the new hospice company had started the approval process. Now, we were not engaged yet. We're just you're in this process of approval where they evaluate and determine if he's eligible, blah, blah, blah. Well, we were still under that old hospice company. And so that was on June 1st? So on June 5th, I get a call at noon from Dad's facility, his director of nursing. And she asked me if I had heard from the current hospice. And I said, no, why? What's going on? She said, she goes, well, that hospice had been in that morning and checked on Dad. And they between hospice and her, the director of nursing, determined that he was actually in an active dying stage. And she told me that two family members could come be with him as long as we needed until the end. So we were not under any type of restriction at this point. She mm-hmm. told us only two, and we also had to, we've had to go through a health check at the front door and answer a questionnaire about, you know, being in contact with a COVID patient, such or have we been sick, are we sick, all that stuff. So that was at noon, and at 1 o'clock, my daughter and I were at his bedside, and that was the first time I had seen him since March face to face, and he looked so withdrawn, and you could tell he had lost so much weight, and so I was really upset about that. Let me stop right there at that moment, because when the nurse, when she checked him out, that PA on the 21st, and told me he had lost so much weight, she said, you know, maybe send him some goodies or bring him some whatever. We don't care what he eats. He needs to gain weight. And my dad is a really good eater. So he's not overweight. He could eat you under the table, especially if you go to a seafood restaurant. He can put some shrimp down. So I'm like, no problem. So I made an order. I ordered some of his favorite cookies, and I made sure that they were individually wrapped so they wouldn't go stale and he could eat them one at a time. And so when I arrived, so, you know, I know he had gotten that box, and I was so excited. And so when I got, when I had stopped by the facility a few days after he got that delivery, I had to stop and drop off some medicine and some, it was something else he needed. I was probably dropping off some drinks and stuff. And I said, hey, did Dad get his cookie? You know? And she goes, oh, was that for him? And I'm like, yeah.
Who said that?
His facility, front desk. And I was like, yeah, it was for him. It was addressed to him. There was a card in there for him telling him, hey, Dad, I need you to start eating cookies, you know. And they apparently ate them. And
they
so
ate them?
When I arrived at his facility, when I was allowed to come in to be by his side, I found the card that I had sent telling him, Dad, here's a batch of cookies. I want you to eat as much as you want when you want them. I need you to gain weight. You know, all this sweet stuff in there to him. It was open. They just threw it in his nightstand. He didn't have a cookie.
Jeez.
He didn't have any. I don't think he had. He maybe got one. I'm not sure, but I know he didn't get
the response.
Because, I mean, people were sending sweet gifts to their facilities for caring for their family members. You know, I mean, expressions of thanks and appreciation and gratitude, that's fine.
But not when it's got
everything.
John's name on it.
Right, exactly. So when we arrived, I inspected Dad from head to toe, and I checked him out, and I was so upset because his toenails were growing out like claws and had grown under his toes, and he had gunk in between his toes where they had not been cleaning him properly and bathing him there in between his toes. and he had a bed sore on his backside near his buttocks, and the hospice had did nothing for him. They should have been treating him for everything, and they didn't do any of that because he never showed up, and he was so dehydrated and hungry. And I was like, because I got there at 1, his lunch come in, and I said, "Dad, are you hungry?" And he was talking a little bit, not much, just maybe 2 words at a time. So he was understanding. He knew who I was. We loved on each other. We had our masks. We had to stay in his room, door closed. We followed their rules. We did everything they wanted because we were so thankful that we were able to come in and be with them. And so I fed him his lunch. He ate everything. He drank everything I got him. I'm like, God, he is starving and he's dehydrated.
Right.
Because
and he probably had a UTI again.
Absolutely. I am so sure of it. So that happened, and then about 2:30, guess who called me? The hospice nurse. She finally called me. She said, "Oh, I wanted to let you know that I saw your dad, and he's in active dying stage, and you should go be with him." Well, I was ready for her. I informed her that I had already been, that I already knew that, and that I was with him, and I had been there for a while, and that I laid in her, and I ripped her up again, another one, upside one down the other, and I was so upset, and she said that if there was anything, was there anything else she could do? I said, "No, you've done enough," and I hung up. I was so upset. So on Saturday, the next day, nobody from hospice showed up until later on. This weekend nurse showed up that late afternoon. And I said, "Well, I'm really surprised that I had not seen or heard anybody because he's in this active dying stage." And she said, "Oh, really? Well, his records don't state that." And I said, "Well, that doesn't surprise me because the nurse is totally incompetent over his care there." I said that. I don't care anymore. I'm past it. I'm past the niceness. And this nurse, this weekend nurse, kind of got some stuff rolling for him. At this time, it's Sunday, Dad starts exhibiting signs of pain, and we start giving him Tylenol, but it just didn't seem like it was enough. You could tell he was in pain. And I was just like, the facility nurse got on the phone and contacted hospice to find out because they were supposed to have provided some comfort meds for PRN as needed, and they never showed up. So finally this facility nurse got the medicines ordered, and they gave them a really low dose, and they were able to relieve him a little bit. Now, they did not give him Ativan. I made sure. I was like, "No, you're not, no." So on Monday the 8th, I could not wait till Monday morning. At 8 a.m. Monday morning, the minute I knew that the new hospice facility would be open, I called and explained my situation. Now, I had engaged with them the week before, and they were starting the approval process. Remember? And explained to them, and I'd asked if they could take over his care to the end. And at that time, we made the appointment for the nurse to be there at 2:30 that afternoon. And that between that, I had to disengage the other hospice and provide proof of that so they can file appropriate insurance accordingly, because you can't have two. And at that time, everything went through, and I was able to do that. So in the meanwhile, I called the hospice and explained to them and fired them. And I went to talk, I was talking to the supervisor of the nurse, because that's who I asked to speak with. And, she didn't care. She did not care. She didn't even want to know why. She's like, "Okay." And within 30 minutes, their discharge took place because all of his meds were ended from the care under their care. And I'm like, well, okay. And then the new hospice nurse came in at 2:30. Within 2 hours of him arriving, they had the meds ready. They had a new special mattress that helps with bed sores or prevention of bed sores. They got a better oxygen machine and the compassion care. They had a nurse sitting by his side till the end. So that was on Monday, the 8th, and by Thursday, the 11th, at 11:22, my dad passed away and has been reunited with my mom in heaven. So that's my heartbreaking journey for my dad and my mom and dad.
To lose both of them. I am so sorry. It's hard enough to lose one, but to lose two, and for both of your parents to have been treated so cruelly and with no dignity, everything they did to your mom and your dad.
Yeah.
And that's important.
And the one thing about the last hospice company, which I appreciated, they didn't drug him up because I made sure. I'm like, please do not drug him up. He doesn't need it. He's not terminal. He's not in that, of cancer or other painful conditions where my mom need a little more. My dad just need a little edge, and they only did that. And he was away. I was singing over him and praying over him, and he would open his eyes and look at me, and he would squeeze my hand. So we had precious, special moments, and he was receiving a little comfort meds at the end, but not Ativan, not the combos, not all that. It was just a little bit of the morphine, just a smidgen, but not enough to knock him out. Because I'm like, no, we're not doing that. You call the shot.
Well,
you have the control.
He died naturally, and you were still able to spend time with him, to talk to him, and to have those final precious moments without being drugged into a coma, and his death was not hastened.
Right. No, it was not. Mm-mm.
So what,
and
in
92.
Most of the shows.
He was 92, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
92.
But most
of
the shows, I talk about the toxic drugs. And in
I
your
know.
Case, you knew enough about it to keep them from giving that to them. But had you not intervened with your mom from the get-go, the very first day they were giving her, injecting drugs, put a catheter in her, and they started the euthanasia process. And that is if you do not know that, this is exactly what happens, and Jenny, you were on top of it, and you were a warrior, a bulldog in protecting your parents, but most of us are in total shock. We have no clue what to do. We just believe whatever they tell us and go along with whatever they say because they're compassionate. No, they're not.
Well, I was doing that at first, because I thought I was being pulled into it just like everybody. And I'm not saying that not everybody doesn't need certain types of level of hospice for certain terminal patients, but I couldn't believe some of this stuff. And when I came in there and started calling the shots, they didn't like that. I wasn't forming friendships there for sure, and I'm okay with that. But when it came to your family member, don't let them bully you. Don't let them tell you this is the way. No, just remember who's paying who here. Your insurance, your Medicare, your Medicaid, we all pay it. We pay for it one way or another. So you have to remind people every once in a while, who's paying who here? You don't let people bully you and tell you what they need to do and how to do it and how it's going to be. No. I'm sorry. But, having to go through this, I first of all, I hated going through it. I hated every minute of it. It wasn't anything I could have ever imagined because, you know, we've had a really hard year of loss anyway. And then to have two more family members pass, like immediate family, I've had four immediate family members die in the last year. And to go through all of this and see how hospice can treat other patients, you know, patients like this, I was appalled. And
right.
I'm pretty ticked off about it. But I hope that somebody learned something from this, you know, through
this.
And that's
what I
my
hope
story.
Too, from your story, your experience with what you went through, you showed
mm-hmm.
us tonight a different side of
mm-hmm.
hospice, yet a discompassionate side, but
mm-hmm.
You know, the bed sores, the toenails, the not showing up,
yeah.
you know, moving your
yeah.
mom multiple times, putting a catheter
yeah.
in. I mean, those are
yeah.
things that are cruel that should not be done
yeah.
to our loved ones. We love
yeah.
them. There are people, and as you say,
yeah.
we're the ones paying the bills, and we have the right
yeah.
to consent. And if they don't get consent, they should not be allowed to give morphine, Ativan, fentanyl, Haldol,
right.
Seroquel, none of that without
no.
the consent from the patient if they're alert, if not, their family members. And you must tell the family member what those drugs will do, and it will take away
no.
your ability to have those precious moments with your loved one like you did with your dad,
right.
to sit
right.
and talk and memory and love on him, sing,
yep.
you know, do whatever you want to do. But
yeah.
nobody has the right to take the last
mm-mm.
chapter of our loved one's life and our time with them.
Right.
And
exactly.
I appreciate you coming on tonight and, you know, giving us detail about what happened to your mom and your dad. So hopefully
well, thank
our
you
listeners.
For the opportunity.
Oh, absolutely. And this is Marty sets this up. So, you know, she runs
thank
everything
you.
In the background. And so if it wasn't for her, we wouldn't be doing this. So I appreciate
yeah.
her, too.
Yeah.
So to all of our listeners, please, I hope you've gained some information from Jenny's story. And these are real people. They don't get paid to come on here and say things that aren't true. These are real stories. And the tragedy now with COVID is there are more and more of our loved ones who are being euthanized as we speak in the nursing homes, in hospice, in hospitals, and it is wrong. It is murder, straight out. It's murder. There's nothing compassionate about this. There's a reason for hospice. They have overstepped. That is not what hospice is doing today. They are taking other people's lives away from them, and it's wrong. It's criminal. So
mm-hmm.
with that, I will say good night to Jenny. Thank you for coming on, and good night
thank
to all
you.
Of our listeners, and we will be back with you in a couple of weeks. Thank you, Jenny. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Bye.
All right. Good night.
Good night.